Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The last few weeks have been a rocky one for President Trump and his relationship with the U.S. military, starting with polls showing that his support was dropping among military members and a recent article in The Atlantic that quoted numerous sources who discussed the commander-in-chief's private disdain for troops, whether they were on active duty or killed or wounded in combat. Although news organizations have corroborated The Atlantic's reporting, the president and his supporters say that such reports are false, and the president is a big supporter of those in uniform. To deflect criticism, the president over the weekend suggested that he was popular with the troops, but not with senior military leaders who support war to help defense companies sell more weapons. It's an interesting stance given the president has also reveled at holding rallies at defense plants, being surrounded by defense CEOs, and touted U.S. arms sales worldwide that have added to the coffers of defense companies. Joining us now to discuss this and more are Frank Kendall, the former Undersecretary of Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, who is a 1971 West Point graduate who retired from the U.S. Army as a lieutenant colonel. He served in a senior executive capacity during the Clinton administration and was a senior political appointee during the Obama administration, but he's also advised Republican administrations over the decades. And I should also point out that he has informally provided advice to the Biden campaign.
Good to be with you, Vago.
And retired United States Navy Commander Buzz Snodgrass, a fighter pilot and Top Gun instructor and 1998 Naval Academy graduate. He also served as former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis's communications director. He's also the CEO of the Defense Analytics Consultancy, and his latest book, Top Gun's Top 10 Leadership Lessons from the Cockpit, will be released next Tuesday. Buzz, really appreciate always having you on the program.
Great to be with you, Vago. Thanks.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. And of course, Bell sponsors this podcast. Frank, you've devoted literally your entire life to U.S. national security. The president's supporters are comparing his comments to President Eisenhower's famous last address, where he discussed the dangers of the military-industrial complex, something that the late great General Goodpaster would point out, that was originally military-industrial congressional complex. But putting beyond all that, you know, what's the fact and fiction here? Because I've been covering this for 30 years and have never seen military members sort of eager to get into wars, ultimately because they're the ones who get shot at. And certainly not to do that to be benefiting defense industry. As somebody who's worn the uniform, served in high office, while also you know, having worked in the industry, what's the fact and fiction here?
President Trump's statement is so patently absurd on its face that it's hard to even talk about it seriously. You know, I've about 50 years experience now in the military and in industry and in government. And, you know, I've never met that I can recall a senior leader in the military who wanted to go to war, who would not have preferred that to be avoided if at all possible. And I think even more remote is the idea that what they would care about is the sales or the profit making of the defense industry. That's the last thing on military leaders' minds. So I think they're just ridiculous statements. The president has done... has so lost his credibility that I guess if you want to talk about the impact of these statements, it's probably a lot less than it would have been potentially at one time, because he has said so many outrageous things over, you know, the last few years. This just goes on that list. And I think to a large extent, people are going to ignore it because of that. But it's still really totally inappropriate for the, you know, the commander in chief to be making comments like this.
Buzz, you've repeatedly served in both combat assignments, but also on the staffs of senior leaders, whether it was with Secretary Mattis, who was a distinguished combat leader in his own right, to John Greenert, somebody with an extraordinary service as a submariner and as an operator. What's your sense on all of this, and maybe what the president is trying to accomplish more broadly, because it doesn't seem as though it's about this specific thing, is it?
No, I think I agree with Frank's assessment overall that it's patently false what the president has claimed. As you mentioned, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in combat, but I've also spent time in the offices for very senior officials. And what strikes me as unique is that when you look at someone like Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, or you look at the chiefs of the service branches, there's never been any conversation where someone's seeking to enter into a conflict because it's somehow advantageous for the defense industrial complex. I mean, like Frank said, that's patently absurd. I think this is just a simple fact. I mean, we've watched this play out time and time again, where President Trump, in an effort to deflect criticism that's directed towards him, will say something absurd like this, and then everyone kind of starts chasing it. And of course, here we are discussing it on the show now. But I think one thing that strikes me, though, is having had a front row seat in the Trump administration for about a year and a half at the beginning of his term, the White House and President Trump himself were constantly encouraging us to increase our foreign military sales to overseas clients. In fact, when President Trump made his first overseas visit to Saudi Arabia, that was a hallmark of his visit, was a $120 billion package that he was touting he had sold them. So I think it's interesting, because when you start peeling this back, it bounces back onto the president and less so on the military leaders.
Both of you, have spent your careers living by an honor code. Frank, you and I over the years have talked about some of the lessons you learned at West Point. You arrived there in 1967. You were commissioned in 1971. Jack Reed was one of your classmates, another person who is regarded as having very, very high ethics. Bus, you pride yourself on that as well. And it goes back to your parents and how they raised you and brought you up as well. What's at stake here, and how does the president at one point did have high support in the military? Military Times did a poll recently that showed that support has softened quite a bit. Although there is this sense that the president has support that might be far wider than people are willing to admit to reporters when they ask them about that. How do you sense this, given that you're all still friends with very, very wide circles of both active, reserve, and retired military members? Frank, maybe you want to start us off?
Well, a lot of interesting features we've all gotten to observe about President Trump. But one of them, I think, is he has no regard for the truth. He uses what he says as just a tactic often to attack people who he views as having attacked him, without any real regard for the veracity of what he's saying. And I think that's a tactic that's probably served him pretty well in business over the years, because you can do it to affect a transaction and then walk away and never deal with that person again or that business again, and then go do it with somebody else. As president, you don't get that. You're on the stage all the time, and you're on the stage continuously. So I think over time, people have come to understand that Donald Trump just says things, and that they don't have any grounding in truth. They're just things he thinks are convenient to the argument he's trying to make at the moment, or the outcome he's trying to get in whatever transaction he thinks he's engaged in. So it's an unfortunate thing. I think the veracity of a president matters. His trustworthiness certainly matters. That's true with whoever he's interacting with, whether it's our men and women in the military, the people who lead them, our allies, or American voters. And I think the Washington Post has documented up to tens of thousands of falsehoods that have been uttered by the president. It's really unprecedented, and he's rather skilled at it. Actually, he can tell more lies per minute than almost anybody I've ever seen. But that's his tactic. It's worked for him, and he continues to do it. This is an example.
Bus?
I think Frank has that adequately covered. I think where that takes me as someone who's, contemplating the next 5, 10, 15 years, what does that mean for practitioners in the national security space and the government space? And I think, you can never discount. I mean, Frank and I both came up through a military career at the beginning of our service careers. And, you just recognize intuitively the strength and the importance that leadership plays to any organization. And of course, now you have an individual who's at the head of the United States of America. And so everyone watches that individual. And whether you like them, you dislike them, et cetera, you still take away these lessons. And my fear is that for a lot of our younger Americans who want to find a life in public service, who might want to seek public or elected office one day, that this becomes the new norm, that you can say anything, do anything, the ends justify the means, and this becomes more acceptable behavior. And I felt that way when I was still working in Secretary Mattis's office and watched, I believe that was during that time frame that the CPAC was occurring, you know, and the president came out and embraced the American flag. And you had a bunch of young American college students who were watching this and cheering loudly at that type of behavior. And so like Frank said, I mean, there's been a lot of falsehood. There's been a lot of outright lies. And that's the danger in my mind, is that you've got to have an honor system. You have to have some sort of code of ethics, an adherence to the rule of law for this country to effectively function moving forward. And you can't just generate a whole new generation of leaders who believe that that no longer counts. That's not going to take us any place that we want to be.
What are the civil military relations implications of this? Frank, you were at West Point during the height of the Vietnam War. You were commissioned while the Vietnam War was ongoing. You didn't get an assignment to Vietnam, but what are the implications of all of this, even stories about what the president may have said, and what are the implications more broadly?
That's a great question. I was about to say that within the military, there is in general still a very strong sense, I think, of honor and the value of being a truth teller. I think it's less so in business, where I have met people in business. It's not necessarily a majority, but who view a lie as a tool in the toolbox. Military people tend to take what they say very seriously, partly because trust is so important in the military. I think it's important in all human relations, frankly, personal relations, business relations, certainly in a chain of command where you have to trust the people on your flanks and the people below you and people above you all. I'm hopeful that President Trump will stand out as an aberration in that regard. Generally speaking, you know, the myths about Washington, for example, are that truth-telling is a virtue and that it's something people should aspire to in everything that they do. Donald Trump has made it, in his mind, apparently the opposite of that. You know, he's been accused of calling people who are the fallen losers and suckers, right? And I think he would probably view people who have a sense of honor and feel compelled to tell the truth in the same way. It's a sad thing to see in another human being, quite frankly. And I have seen some studies, some surveys that suggest that cheating has become more prevalent, that, you know, not getting caught is the thing that people tend to be focused on as opposed to doing the right thing. I'd like to see some leadership in this country, frankly, that would turn that around and start to restore some of the values that we've traditionally held out to be American, frankly.
And obviously, right at the heart of, I think, Vice President Biden's campaign, that is kind of the featured and central message in terms of a return to normality. Bus, you know, you've been looking at some of these issues as well, and obviously you served at a time when military service was something that was, you know, respected and acknowledged, and people were supporting the troops, even if they disliked the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, which was a little bit different from what Frank had to experience when he was in uniform. What's your sense in terms of the civil-military relations element of this? Because there are, you know, senior officers who've been somewhat parsimonious with the truth, I think we could say it. Others would say that they did work for rather accomplished liars in their own right. But what are the implications? I mean, is this a manifestation of poor relations we enjoy that are civil military, or a reflection? I mean, how do you see all of this?
Well, look, I mean, a lot of times you have to ask yourself, what is the specific risk you're facing? What is at risk, and then how long do you face that risk? And I think that the primary risk we're facing right now is that the U.S. military as Frank just pointed out, I mean, it largely relies on a very strong system of trust and honesty, right? So as my background as a fighter pilot, I had to be able to trust the 18-year-old plane captain who gave me two thumbs up saying that he checked everything and the plane was ready to fly, that was indeed the case. And in fact, the most difficult punishments, or I guess the toughest punishments you ever handed out to a junior member of the military was when they just outright lied and deceived. So the problem with the U.S. military right now that they're facing with this particular commander in chief is that the military has long enjoyed the highest rating for public trust. And you now have a president who can act indiscriminately, who can easily place the military in a very difficult positions where they are, it seems like they're being forced to choose between either blind loyalty and adherence to what the president has asked them to do, much like the clearing of Lafayette Park, which puts the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in a very difficult situation. It puts the Secretary of Defense in a difficult situation, or whether they bias towards the rule of law and just doing what is in the long-term best interest of the military, but then they get cross-threaded with their commander in chief. And I think that is once again that element of leadership where that construct is broken down, because most good leaders know that it, other than dire and extreme situations, you just don't put those who are in your organization in that type of situation in the first place. You don't want to put the military in a place where they have to lose confidence with the American public. And unfortunately, we've seen that play out time and time again. When I was early with Mattis's office, it was largely the FBI because of the, you know, those waters that were swirling around James Comey and others. So you had the FBI, you had the intelligence community because of their assessment of the 2016 election and Russian efforts to provide disinformation to the American public. And so now here you are where the U.S. military is certainly in the hot seat and will continue to be so, especially after I think candidates on both sides have said that should the other lose, the military would escort them out of the White House, which thankfully military leaders have said that's not their place. They're not going to do that. But I think, you know, for the average American who does not spend a lot of their time focused on these issues, thinking deeply about what the regulations or the rules say, they're simply going off what they hear on the news. And that places the military in a place where they could rapidly lose the trust that has been built over the course of many decades.
Bus, I want to ask you this question because I should note that your first book was Holding the Line Inside Trump's Pentagon with Secretary Mattis, which came out last October. So you're already proving to be a prolific author with that great Naval Academy education of yours. Did you ever see what did you think when you were in because you were in the room? Certainly with Secretary Mattis and sharing his thoughts when he had visited with the president, but also when the president would come to the Pentagon. How did what do you know more deeply about this relationship that everybody else is reporting on at this point, right? In terms of how the president would behave toward military members or what he thought or may have said, or you may have heard from other senior leaders, because heard all sorts of things over the years about what the president, you know, whether he was talking about John McCain or others.
Yeah. And so the reality for the American public is that it's very difficult to sort fact from fiction, because the president has proven through his actions, not just, which I guess are his words in this case, that he can be very indiscriminate with what he says. He can say things that I think most people, especially early when he was running for office in the first year of his presidency, would shock us. And it's just simply become the new norm. On the flip side of that, I would say that it's no surprise that information is routinely weaponized in Washington, D.C., especially for political purposes. And I'll never forget, you know, for example, I was at the meeting with President Trump and Vice President Pence and Secretary Mattis and others when it was alleged that he had said that the members of the military were dopes and babies and that he would never go to war with them because they're all a bunch of losers. And, you know, I was at that meeting, and when I read that excerpt from the book titled A Very Stable Genius, I kind of shook my head and said, well, this is ridiculous. It's completely false. Nothing like that ever occurred. The danger is that everyone now picks it up and runs with that narrative and takes something that's patently false and then kind of turns it into something that's not only perceived as true, but frankly, because of the way the president behaves, could be very well true. So, you know, it's just a really damnable state of affairs, if you will, because unfortunately, unlike his past predecessors, President Trump doesn't normally comport himself in a way that when an excerpt or when an assertion is made people could easily say, no, that doesn't sound like him at all. But his own public statements have unfortunately put himself in shoal waters. And I think that the other aspect of this as well that that hurts the president is, I think in his mind, much like Frank alluded to at the beginning of our conversation, as a businessman, you know, it was always deflect, point the finger at the other guy, raise the stakes, raise the ante in a negotiation, be absurd. And like Frank said correctly, I mean, he's the president of the United States all day, every day, year round. And he's always on the public stage. And so something he said a month ago can easily be pointed out to demonstrate that what he said today was patently false. And not only do you lose credibility with your electorate, but you also lose credibility where I think it really matters most, which is also with your allies and partners. And we've seen, again, we're very fixated on this narrow topic, but what we haven't necessarily talked about is the damage that has wrought with longstanding alliances and partnerships, and also how I believe it has emboldened many of our competitors and adversaries around the world.
I want to get to that, but bring Frank into this, right? I mean, on the one hand, there are those who say that, you know, he treats folks with kindness and with respect, even though he can be very crass in some of these interactions, because I think he does play to a crowd, right? A raucous enlisted military crowd. He's going to play to them differently than he does to senior leadership. And it's a great divide and conquer tool, right? I'm on the side of the troops. I want to get him out of Afghanistan. I think everybody wants to get out of Afghanistan or Iraq. The question is how you do so responsibly and not have a bigger troop surge you're going to have to do downstream because you didn't get the job done right. And there are folks who've got a lot of concerns that the deal we're striking, for example, with the Taliban, is ultimately going to be something that is going to backfire and actually betray Afghans who have been the ones paying the ultimate price much more in much larger numbers than we have, as bad as that has been for us. Frank, I mean, how do you sense the, you know, as Bus said, the alliance and broader sort of strategic implications of all of this, even if it's a misrepresentation, right? If, you know, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people who are not fans of the president. You don't know and can't easily sort fact from fiction, right? I mean, there are people who, if you said like these things were attributed to them, they wouldn't believe it. Whereas the president takes this journey that actually almost acknowledges what was said about him, right? I mean, there are other statements that eventually will come out and say, oh yeah, you know, people cover for him. And then he goes, oh yeah, well, I said it anyway. And that passes because then there's the new, you know, that kind of gets reset multiple times a day because of the statements that are being made. I mean, do you see something that's a longer lasting damage?
Yeah, there are several things in there, Vago. There's a value in consistency, I think, particularly in international relations. There's an aspect of this that you haven't really touched on, I think, and it's the degree to which what Trump has said here is a failure of leadership. It's an egregious failure, I think, to criticize your subordinates in front of their subordinates. And even if Donald Trump believed what he said, to say so publicly and transmit to every single man, woman in uniform, his disdain or disrespect for the people that they report to, right, is an extremely significant failure on his part. If he really felt that way, he should be replacing some of the people that he put into positions. If he thinks they're trying to go to war just to pass, get money to contractors, which is, again, absurd. But it's sending a message that is very harmful to all our men and women in uniform. And that's a fundamental failure of leadership. To get to your other point about relationships with the allies and some of the moves that Trump has made here, it seems clear to me that a large part of what he has done with troop drawdowns, for example, and recently just announced one in Iraq, is more about politics than it is about strategy. And one thing I think that you can observe very consistently about Donald Trump is, again, he's all about tactics. He does what seems to be attractive in the moment, without an enormous amount of regard for it, and more about what the appearance is in the moment, not the substance, regardless of the long-term impacts. And that becomes observed by friends and foes alike, and they have to adjust their behavior around that. It's an unfortunate You know, another thing like his tendency to tell falsehoods all the time is that his actions are very, very short-term oriented and very politically oriented in many cases. And there are lots of examples of that.
You know, when the president got elected, his popularity with military members was very, very high. And at the end of the day, if you're in an organization that is about honor and service and sacrifice, how the president could have the degree of support he had for as long as he had it in military circles, it certainly appears so among the retired community. You know, the question that people ask sometimes is, you know, how can people of faith, deep faith, evangelicals, support somebody who is somewhat challenged? I think folks can agree maybe on ethics and credibility. How do these things all coexist? Frank, maybe you can start us off and then Bus, maybe finish it off.
Vago, you've asked an important question, one that to some degree mystifies me, is how can people continue to support President Trump? Particularly people have, and genuinely, I think, have the values that you describe. I think there's a perception in some people's minds that President Obama was not strong and that Donald Trump is. I think that's a serious error to have that judgment. But they looked at things like the Syria red line. But about the only way you can excuse Donald Trump is if you convince yourself he's better than the alternative. And I think I've felt for some time that Joe Biden, should he win, his greatest challenge and his most important challenge is going to be to convince Americans who did not vote for him that the Democratic Party and people who support the Democratic Party are not evil, that Americans are decent people on both sides of the political aisle, and that they can generally agree on moderate and reasonable approaches to most problems if they just talk to each other. I think there's been a very concerted effort to convince people on the right in particular that the people who disagree with them are evil. And I won't say that this is entirely one-sided. I think there's some of it on both sides. But I think that's a fundamental problem. It's referred to as tribalism or polarization. I think it goes deeper than that and has to do with the information systems we tend to live in, who we talk to. If we can't fix this, I don't know how our country can move forward. And in my mind, that's going to be Joe Biden, if he wins, his greatest challenge.
Bus?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've noticed since I retired and I've had a chance to travel around the United States, talk to a lot of people from various political affiliations, is you take for granted, I think, that if you are deeply rooted in the military or in some form of government service, that you constantly work with people who have views that differ from your own. And that's not necessarily the reality for a lot of locations in America. You as Frank mentioned, you have tribalism. You tend to listen to the same news outlets. You gravitate towards the information that you want to hear. And there's no desire to listen to the other side. So one, I think there's this natural effort right now where people are just literally talking past each other. So I think that's resulted in three reasons, Vago, when you asked why people would still vote for President Trump if they don't necessarily align with his value system. And I think the first one is a lack of recognition for, in this case, the Republican Party and conservative Christians, you know, just the deep-seated frustration that group has felt for years with regards to the fast pace of social change that they've seen, that they felt that they experienced during the Obama years. So they feel disenfranchised. And so they can say, well, look, I'm not really voting for President Trump. I'm voting for what you get with a Trump administration. The other aspect of this, of course, is that the administration is more willing than most, during my lifetime at least, to play to the fears of that constituency and to stoke those fears. And we've seen that everything from the recently with calling into question the veracity of mail-in ballots, encouraging people to commit a felony by voting twice. I mean, you're playing into those deeply held fears and it's being amplified within those communities. And then also just, you know, because of that, people say, and I've heard this multiple times, that, look, I'm not really voting for President Trump. I'm voting for Vice President Pence, or I'm voting for the ability to carry on with the policies that we have liked that we've seen from the Trump administration. So I think that's probably the biggest danger signal for the Biden camp as the campaign rolls to the stop here in 2 months, is just the fact that it's not just a personal contest between Vice President Biden and President Trump. It's also how can you reassure men and women on the right who might be willing to cross over, much like we saw the opposite effect in 2016, that the policies that, that Vice President Biden and Kamala Harris would put in place would actually include them as well. And it would be, much like Frank said, something one tent that would hold all of America underneath it.
Gentlemen, thanks very much as always for joining us. We appreciate it. An important issue. We'll continue discussing it as we go forward. Thanks very, very much. Again, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Vago.
Vago, great to be with you. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.